everyone. Brian Hutchison here. Welcome back to episode 5 of Behind the Science of Career Development. Quick programming note, if you will, if you missed last episode, just to give you a heads up that we are trying to be more consistent with the podcast in 2021 and also to change the focus and the tone of them just a little bit. So please look for this episode and future episodes in the last week of each calendar month. And the goal here is really to go beyond the APCDJ, the Asia Pacific Career Development Journal, and broadly bring on guests that are experts in different aspects of the field of career development and hopefully have a lot of fun while doing it. So for this episode, I am so excited. I'm bringing on my oldest bestie in the entire field of career development. So it's a real pleasure to bring in Dr. Tina Anktal from Portland State University. Tina, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brian. It's great to be here and great to see you again.
So for the first time, I'm going to ask you to briefly introduce yourself, and you're my first guest where I'll have to say no incriminating information about me or my past in the field of career development, please. So tell us a little bit about what you do and how that influences the field of career development.
Thanks again for having me here. And I'm always excited to talk about the field of career development, in particular, how career development supports people with disabilities in their journey with work and really life in general. And I believe in that the centrality of work and how it impacts all of us. And when you have a disability, and in particular, work is usually one of the spots that you need additional support and help. So I'm a clinical rehabilitation counselor. I started in the field of rehab counseling, working for the state of Oregon a long time ago. I think it's been over 25 years now, and give myself away there. And I worked there in a state agency and really gave me a flavor for the kinds of hardships that one can occur when you have functional limitations. And that work sprung me forward into my PhD, University of Wisconsin-Madison, where I did a lot of work around self-determination and understanding how the theory of self-determination influences one's motivation and ability to really follow through and take action on things that can be impactful, especially when that relates to finding a job, keeping a job, and being motivated to know what you want to do and how to do it. So that's really where I've spent my career, and looking at that intersection of work and disability. I've taught clinical rehabilitation counseling. I've taught school counseling now for quite some time. I find myself in an administrative role as of late at Portland State University, overseeing academic affairs in the College of Education there. I think that's probably enough. I also have a private practice where I just now, but since I've been an associate dean, I only do clinical supervision, but I also have had a private practice for about 12 years now. And that work allowed me to get a lot more hands-on career counseling experience and explore my own theories and ways of doing that. And that's what I do now, is I supervise people who are working on their LPC, who want to focus on disability and career. Yeah. And I have about, at any given time, I have 6 to 8 supervisees who I spend 2 to 3 hours a month with.
Yeah, so a broad, deep background in an area that I think one of the valuable things that I've taken out of our friendship and our professional relationship, and I feel like we've navigated both most of the years that we've known each other, is how, I guess, ignorant I feel about this aspect of career development. I think somehow, and maybe we can start with the United States and then maybe talk more globally, but how does someone like me, who has such a deep interest in the field, who goes to good schools, who gets good training, and then I meet you right after grad school, and I feel like I know absolutely nothing about the vocational rehabilitation side of career development. Just give maybe some short perspective on like how those two things exist in the United States, and then I'll ask a follow-up and maybe we can focus a little more globally.
Sure. So in the United States, things can be pretty siloed. so that there's a separate service system set up to support people with disabilities. So in the United States, that would be the vocational rehabilitation system. But I understand many other countries have similar systems. I recently did some work in Singapore over the last year with SG Enable, and they have a very fabulous system for people with disabilities. But the unique, because of the unique nature of disability, there's often a separate system. And what that's done is kind of is create some silos that are really artificial, because if you or I were to become disabled, then odds are we will at some point in our life, just aging nonetheless. You know, I've already had my first back surgery. It happens. So fortunately, I've recovered and don't have any functional limitations at this point in time. But so either temporarily or permanently, when somebody experiences a disability, they need all kinds of assistance. So we set up these systems to allow that to occur, but they don't always overlap and connect necessarily with the medical system or with, say, the workforce development systems that exist in most countries have a workforce development system where people who need help with work go and finding work go.
I think you just said something so powerful that's striking me. And, you know, particularly in like the multicultural social justice space where I work, like we have this idea of like alterity or othering of people. And this idea that all of us will most likely have to access some aspect of the disability-based system, I think is a really powerful concept. When you work with students, maybe teaching a career counseling class, like what are some of the things that you do in the classroom or that you talk about in the classroom that helps them sort of bridge that gap the way that you just helped me bridge it a little bit more?
Sure. And when I teach career development, I teach it to all specialties of counseling. Well, we have four programs. So think mental health, marriage and family, school, and rehab counselors. So it's a broad breadth. And so one of the things I think about is universal design, which is a principle that says that we want access, whether that be physical access or virtual, whatever it is, to be as seamless as possible, as easy as possible. And when we do that, we help everybody. So I think about how do we provide career development services in a way that's accessible to everybody? And then what do you really need to pay attention to include the person with a disability? Mm. And for example, strengths and weaknesses. Brian, if you've had a back injury and you can't lift more than 10 pounds, mm-hmm. and you can't sit for more than 15 minutes at a time, and I don't address that with you as one of your functional limitations, we could put it in the weakness category. We could do whatever. I don't like to sugarcoat things. I'm pretty transparent, but we all have weaknesses. We all have things we want to steer clear of. We're not, you know, we want to build upon our strengths. So if I don't address that with you, I haven't done my job. Mm. So I think helping people see their strengths and weaknesses, for example, is really something that can be influential for everybody, but critical when you have an impairment, that you have to identify that and name it.
So then this idea of universal design, it seems like it could maybe have two elements. One is sort of the design of the workplace has to be universally acceptable. But it also seems like you're suggesting that like the way that we talk with people, evaluate people in the career space, that there can be some universality to that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So when we talk about assessments, I particularly am drawn to life design theories and approaches that can be more accessible and I think work really well. I mean, I'm glad you brought the global diversity and equity conversation into the disability into that space, because it absolutely is part of that space. And the more that we can follow that through, I think the better as well. So making those individualized approaches such as life design theory and using interview formats can be much more uniquely applied when possible. So those are the kinds of approaches I like to do with assessment.
Yeah. So if I follow this line of at least my thinking as we talk about this, where really the adaptation here is to expand all career professional service providers practice so that it's consistently inclusive, whether or not you're specialized in vocational rehabilitation. My hunch would be is that if we do this work long enough, a disability is probably playing a part in a client's life and their career decision-making process a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And we may not know that.
Right. So we have hidden disabilities and we have visible disabilities. We have things like things that are hidden might be a learning disability, an anxiety disorder, depression. All of those things really fall into that impairment range, right? Somebody might have diabetes. Those are things that we can't always see. You might, you know, you're going to know if you work with somebody who's deaf or has vision loss, or uses a wheelchair. Those are things that are just really front and center and you're gonna know about, but you may not know if somebody is on the autism spectrum and they're high functioning. And those things are important to understand and to do. If we're gonna think about, you know, the foundation of, I think, career development, a lot of it is trait and factor and fit. You know, some of that is person environment fit. And so there's just some nuts and bolts that I think are useful for most people, but really critical when you have a disability. So yeah, so part of what I'm doing lately in my training is really trying to bring a theory of career development for people with disabilities. A theory, maybe that's not the right word. I think more of a strategy and a practice and a way to train the general workforce development professional on how to approach working with a client who has a disability.
So by workforce development, like we're kind of all inclusive here, I'm guessing, like coaches, facilitators, counselors, human resources, psychologists. Yeah, the whole, okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The last couple of trainings have been more to, well, I guess there might've been one of everybody in that pool
great
who did the training, but yeah, really even geared for the CDF. So the career development facilitator at that, because that's who sees the most people. So I think it's really important to have those high volume coaches and professionals who are maybe front and center, have this background and also know where to refer when it's a more difficult case.
Yeah, and I think that's a parallel that you and I have both shared for a long time of spreading the sort of expertise and the research and the models as widely as possible. Like I always say, like, let's meet the career interventions where they're at, not try to self-select the people that we prefer to work with. I mean, good career interventions benefit everyone. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yep. So, I agree.
So you sort of suggested this model. So if I were a client coming to you, and let's say that I want to make sure that the language stuff is sort of clear here. So like if I didn't have a disability before and I have one now, I would probably say acquired disability. Is that the right language to use?
Absolutely. Yes. That's the language that we use in the research and
okay,
the literature.
Great. Yeah. I'm pretty sure there was a beer at a conference sometime that where you taught me that. So I've been such a good student, Tina. Tina always grades on a curve with me. I think that's maybe why we're friends. So, okay. So I've, and I think that a lot of your private practice work has been with adults that have acquired disability. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
So in my mind, not having acquired a disability in my life, I've actually had a disability and it was corrected basically as a young child. So I've thought about this quite a bit from a different perspective, but I got to think that emotion and fear, there's got to be a lot of intensity to when a client like that first comes to meet with someone like you. Could you describe, is there any sort of pattern of behavior and of experience that someone who has acquired a disability brings to you?
Well, that's a whole field of study.
Oh, look at me.
look at you. You're on the right track. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a range of things. So it's psychosocial adaptation to disability is really the subset of the field of clinical rehabilitation counseling or rehab psychology that looks at this experience, and people have studied it from, you know, what is the experience of cancer like? What is the experience of a seizure disorder like? What about a spinal cord injury? And are there similarities and differences according to, and there are models that people have developed based upon the research. That being said, my experience is to address it more generally and to understand that much like grief and the grieving process when somebody loses a loved one, that's the adjustment, is a similar adjustment that needs to occur when one has a disability. And what we hear from those who, I don't know that one's ever adjusted, you know, and there's always a before and an after. But I think there are things that we look for and things that we hope for. And some of that is benefit finding can occur. So when somebody, first of all, when someone comes to me in a fairly like broken state is what I would say. So I had the pleasure of working with one man who had lost his vision overnight from a stroke. while actually going through alcohol detox. And that can be a side effect. So he was professional, you know, worked in the IT industry and really lost it all through that process, lost his marriage. You know, it was hard to parent. Suddenly he's a single parent. And so when he came to me, I mean, it took a long time for him just to kind of sit there. And we just had to work our way through that grieving process. And then eventually we got to, how do you rebuild your career?
Yeah.
How do you do this? Do you want to do it? And that's not a typical client. That's somebody who, you know, I saw in a very acute stage. But since we're talking about what that looks like, he came to mind for me. But somebody who comes, let's say, is already, they've had their acquired disability a while, and maybe they've been through a recovery process, and they're usually my clients came to me from a referral from the state agency who wanted me to help them develop a career plan.
Right.
So even so, I would utilize assessments that would really help them articulate their before and after to the acquired disability, because I think being really comfortable with the after gives them some strength and a solid place to build from.
Yeah.
So knowing, for example, you might ask the question when you're doing career assessment, what are your hobbies? That's a very common question. Tell me about that. And to have someone say, well, I used to weightlift and I can't do that anymore. That was my outlet. But now I've discovered cooking. I've discovered doing healthy cooking, and that's something I can do. And to hear that articulated and then to magnify that and amplify it for them and talk about, wow, how resilient you are that you've been able to find this new outlet and how can we build on that? So really there's that acquired disability requires an adjustment process. And I, sometime in there, when I have time, I have a paper in me where I'd love to write about how good career counseling can facilitate adjustment, because it is so much about the before and after.
And if I may reverse that, it seems to me that almost all career counseling is about adjustment as well. You know, back to that principle of universality, like I don't focus my training and the stuff that I do specifically on clients, working with clients with disability. But you know me, I always have the easy peasy model, right? Understand, clarify, adapt. I mean, that's what career work is to me. And while we're shading it with some specific things that need to be understood about disability, things that need to be clarified and these adaptations, there's also that broader, I think, universality to it as well. So I want to focus on your model now. And when I think about like approaches or models, for me, it's always more interesting to think about it from what the counselor's thinking about before they act in session, because the client never knows what your theory is, what your model is, right? You don't sit there and say, and now I'm going to do this technique. So when you first sit down with a client and you're thinking about working with them from your model, like what's the first thing, what's sort of the compass point that you have in mind as you get started?
I really get started with understanding their story. I really want to deeply know them and their story. And that's that first step. And so that's what in this four-step model that we've developed. I need to give credit to my partner, Aaron Lesson, in this work, because he's come from the workforce development model. And we've kind of merged a lot of the nuts and bolts to get to this four-step model. But so really, it's like, how do you use basic helping skills to help someone tell their story? And you don't need to have a master's degree in counseling to be able to do that. You can do it at a greater level when you're a highly trained counselor. Absolutely. And you can maybe take it in different directions, but everybody can use empathy and understand somebody's story and help them in that process can be very therapeutic. So, but there's certain things I do when I'm eliciting the story that's based upon motivational theory of self-determination.
Yep.
Can I tell you a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Is that okay?
Real quick, if I can just interject a quick story of my own. So you really have me thinking of a conversation I had once with Dr. Mark Savickas. And I said, hey, you know, this career construction interview, if you took the word career off the cover, there's nothing career about it, right? It's an interview about life. And he looks at me, he's like, duh, Brian. And that was duh as in D-U-H, right? And this idea that like our stories are ours. They're not necessarily just career stories. They are the story of our life in which career, I don't know. I always see it as like fitting or weaving in.
Absolutely.
And I can just picture you having seen you work with students so much, just eliciting that story so artfully. So tell me a little bit about this theory that you keep in mind while you do this work.
Well, there's certain things I'm listening for. So if you think about a three-legged stool, okay, it's got three legs. Okay, good. I figured as much. And if one of those legs, you were closer, I might just give a little tiny, you know.
So I'm sort of playing like bestie bingo here. Like every time I can get her off track or laugh a little bit, I'm filling out a little bingo card and seeing if I can win the game.
Okay, so it's a three-legged stool. I'm getting us back on track. And if one leg of the stool is short, right, then you're not going to be stable. So there's three things that I'm listening for, and those really are based upon self-determination theory. So I'm listening for autonomy, competence, and connection. And those are really three basic human needs that I think we need in order to take action in our lives, in order to get where we need to go. And we all know that no career intervention is going to be successful if the person who's looking for the job doesn't do it, right? It's got to be up to the individual to follow through and do it. So autonomy really is, and those are things that are, I think, important for all of us, especially important when you have a disability. But the research comes from DC and Ryan, and It's not based upon the field of disability. It's been applied a lot in special ed, but it comes from general psychology. So autonomy is really important. You know, people need to have some level of control over their lives. They need to feel that they can control their own behavior. They do something, it happens. So competence, that you need to be able to build that competence to develop mastery over a task. So self-efficacy, basically, you know, those two things really interact. And then connection or connectedness, having a sense of belonging and connectedness to others is really critical. And I think about what we're going through now with the pandemic, and isolation can be so limiting. Mm. And people will talk about how that limits their motivation. So those are the things I'm listening for, and I'm trying to take note of and then build my assessments around. So really gathering information about, and you can do that in a variety of ways. I have some little tricks. I have people talk about their best and worst jobs. I have folks tell me, I'm listening for, like, what are their barriers to employment? Where are their strengths when they're telling me that? I'm listening for areas of resistance, because that's where I think probably folks aren't feeling very competent when they're resisting. So that's really broad and big, but I'm not asking any kinds of tricky questions, but I am like doing follow-up questions around listening for those three areas.
So I love this point in the conversation. And so a lot of times what I try to picture is you and I might be considered experienced or even master counselors, right? We've been doing this mm-hmm. for a little bit and studying this and taking trainings and getting better. And so I always try to picture in the audience out there the student or the beginning counselor. And so mm-hmm. what we're talking about here, I think, is sort of a more informal, semi-structured interview where you're really relying a lot on your clinical experience over the years. And you're sort of like very naturally asking questions, it almost feels like you're getting a cup of coffee with a friend, but the whole time you're paying attention to these markers throughout that sort of fill in the pieces of information that fit your model. And so an adaptation for a beginning counselor for that, or a beginning coach for that, would just be to sort of be prepared, maybe even have an interview sheet in front of you to do that, to make sure that as you grow into your own mastery of this, that you're following sort of basically the form that comes out of the function of this initial interview. Did I say that mm-hmm. accurately for the way that you
approach? Yeah, absolutely. So when I'm teaching people how to do this, we work with case studies.
Okay.
And then, you know, with a partner, read the case study and pull out, what are aspects of autonomy you see? What are aspects of competence? Is there a human connection there? Are they part? And what kind of follow-up questions would you want to ask? Mm-hmm. So if I were to ask you, like, what was your favorite job? And you tell me, I don't know what you're going to tell me. And then I might say, what were you really good at in that job? Mm-hmm. If you asked me what my worst job ever was, I would tell you it was working in a lumber mill when I was 18. And the reasons it was the worst job is because I had no autonomy. Mm-hmm. I was terrible at it. I could not figure out how to pull the lumber off the belt. It just didn't work for me. I didn't have the flip down. Sure. With the gloves on. So I didn't have the skill set. And it was just, I had to show up, work a shift, leave. I couldn't talk to anybody. I'm such a social person. So you could get several months, you know, you could learn a lot about me just by having me tell you why that was such a terrible job. And I only lasted a week, by the way.
Yeah. And I love, you know, I think some people or some newer coaches or counselors might stay away from the worst job because they're afraid it'll turn too negative. And mm-hmm. and what I find, like when I run groups, I always ask as an opening to groups, you've seen me do this, you know, give your name or whatever information and then your least favorite food. And there is something in the human spirit that like can transition from negative to positive by being able to communicate these types of experiences. I know I shared with you, I've worked in three factories when I was young. And it's the same thing that, you know, our personalities are stifled by those environments. And then the type of work that we're asked to do doesn't allow for creativity or flexibility, right?
Right. And I think sometimes when you ask people to tell you about their worst job, there can be some relief in that because they're like, oh, now she knows how much I hate that and she won't be recommending that.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. And again, it is a shared human experience. I mean, even these negative things, I think, help us connect and make it okay to talk about bad things or things that aren't good, right? Or that we're not good at. And to be able to do that freely, I mean, as always, I experience as empowering in session.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Just to follow up on what you were saying earlier about working with the more novice counselor or career coach. The other thing I think is really critical when you're gathering the story is to avoid problem solving. Mm. So we focus a lot on that and to focus on listening and asking follow-up questions. So using that, looking for autonomy, competence, and connection can allow for those nice follow-up questions without jumping into problem solving. Yeah. And that's generally where folks go when they are doing career coaching to begin with, when you first get started. So it takes, but allowing that story to come out saves you a lot of time and problem solving down the road.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so we focused on the story. Let's walk through these other, I think, three steps of the model. Do I have that right?
Sure. I mean, yeah, and I think those are a little bit more basic. That first one is really where I like to dive in and I think put my own flavor
je ne sais quoi.
It. There you go. You said it. but the next is assessment, and I already talked some about life design, and I like using the career style interview. What's the new name for it? I forget.
Our deepest apologies to Dr. Mark Savickas. We've forgotten.
Yeah.
I always have career construction interview seared into my brain. Do I have it right?
I think it's career. Yeah, I think it's just career construction interview, but originally they started in another direction. And there's another tool called My Story that's been adapted for more universal design and works well with children or people with limited cognition. So I always talk about that assessing, but I think there's nothing wrong with owning and doing some basic good old career assessment, and in particular looking at things that are accessible and we know are valid and reliable instruments. So I think there's a range of those out there where we can look at somebody's interests and their personality and all of those achievements, background limitations. So that I think is fairly straightforward, but how we do that I think is really important, and really looking at barriers and strengths, an assessment process that pulls all that out. What I've seen over the course of my clinical work with people with disabilities is they get assessed a lot and they're pretty burnt out by that process, and they don't feel like it fits them or matches them. And similar to what I think a lot of people experience when they take an online search inventory, it comes up with, I think it's unfortunate that it names job titles at all. Because I think what that does is it, you know, I'm preaching to the choir here, but what that does is that gives people a concrete answer that they say, that doesn't fit me. I don't want to be an orthodontist. You've got to be kidding me. So
yeah,
people get stuck. So a lot of, again, the art of assessment, I think, is helping people get unstuck and look at themes and try and find out where that fits for them. So I have some tools that I particularly like that help with that.
Yeah. I think you're touching on something for me that might be another episode someday. But, you know, if we look at the history of assessment and how the frequency of it has been ramped up in a lot of cultures, you know, we look at school systems in the United States, for example. Mm-hmm. I think that we as the counselor or the coach have to do new things to bridge and make the assessments feel more human again.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I like to do, well, A is more qualitative assessments because they're process oriented, but even doing more things to do quantitative assessments together in some way. But yeah, we've done something around assessment that I think has made it a difficult thing for many clients to grapple with in a positive way.
Absolutely. That's what I've seen in practice. So there's really an art of like, how do we map all this out? Mm-hmm. I stole a tool from person-centered planning in the special education world called What Works and What Doesn't Work. And it generally, in special ed, it shows up on the big whiteboard and everybody throws up. And the parameters of the game really are you only put the highest level things, the things that absolutely work. Mm-hmm. And then the things that absolutely don't work. So let's say I'm working with an adult who's a recovering alcoholic. So, and he says, there's no way I could work in a bar. So I would put what doesn't work there. Or somebody who has legal parameters, I might put like they can't drive. So what does work? Public transportation or a supervisor who can provide visual notes. That's what I know works. So whatever those things are, I find that process, I really trust that process deeply. And I have had a client I've been so stuck with that when we finish that, we can't see something emerge.
Yeah.
So I like to do that and then see, I like the metaphor of like a sieve. Don't know if all your listeners will know what that is, but if we were to put something through a sieve, we see what falls out, you know, what,
yeah.
And usually one or two things do.
Yeah. And so if I'm understanding, so that what you're really doing is sort of is getting the client's focus away from the gray stuff in the middle, right? We're pushing to black and white sort of thinking as a tool for clarifying what's most important, as a tool for identifying things. Because when we're only stuck in the uncertainty in the middle, that's a very stressful place to be.
Right. And it can allow that value conversation to come forward. Mm-hmm. And like, I know, you know, these are the things that are really important. Like, I'm not going to be happy if I don't have this. So I'm going to put that up there. And then we can go back to that list of job ideas that maybe the assessments generated, and we can cross things off.
Yeah.
Or we can say, oh, this one's interesting. Let's explore that a little bit more. Let's go through that informational interview process. So that's really the career planning step for me is, is weeding through all of that using, I hadn't thought about that as a black and white tool, but it absolutely is. And it does work.
You know, it sort of refreshes the mind to be able to go back to the more difficult things, right? Like, like when I'm stuck, it's because I can't get out of the uncertain area in between. And it's refreshing to be able to know like, okay, at least I have these no's and these yeses for sure. And then I'm almost better able to go back into the parts that are more difficult for me. I think that's a great, I'm going to take that one and use it in my own practice. So,
well, do it. It's not mine. It's just something I gravitated towards as I felt so challenged in my private practice at times. You know what it's like as a career counselor, you can feel a lot of pressure that I got to figure this, I got to help this person figure this out. So I always say, let's just work this process. And we'll, something will happen in the process. Awesome. We'll get there.
Awesome. And I think we have, is there one more? Counting's not my strong suit. We have one more.
Yeah, there is. And what is the last step? It's really the job placement process. I can't remember. I think.
Are you sure? If only we had the creator of this process, access to them. I'm sure they would know.
Well, the last step is where we really focus on job accommodations, okay? And those nuts and bolts, labor market information, of course, but those things that are, I think, extra when you have a client with a disability. So I'm a big fan of the Job Accommodation Network, askjan.org. You can use that all over the world. It's great. You can look things up by impairment, by job title, you name it. I can say, you know, my left hand doesn't work very well and see what accommodations are out there. So I'm a big fan of that. And really
that'll be in the show notes. So we'll make sure that we take some of these resources and put them in the show notes so that everyone can access them.
Great. So that's the basics. I think some additional things to look out for when you're doing career development with somebody with a disability.
Yeah. And before we go, I do want to tackle one more thing that I hear a lot from counselors and career professionals at this stage, which is how to coach and work with clients around disclosure of disability, around asking for accommodation, and around communicating. Yeah. I think that this is, as you know, my work, I'm a big fan of these things are present, and whether or not they get addressed is all on us, whether or not we turn away from them or lean into them. And so if we wanted the listeners out there to lean into helping clients with these types of issues, what are some strategies or some things that you think that a working career professional should keep in mind?
Thanks. I was just looking up something to get it right for you. I want to give a plug for the Institute on Employment and Disability that is out of Cornell University. And because they tackle this disclosure as well as other topics around disability, but they tackle it really well. That's a unique conversation. And we definitely do talk about that quite a bit in my private practice, in my supervision, in the training that I do. So thanks for bringing that up. I'd forgotten to. It really depends. And in the United States, we have law that says if I disclose my disability, I can be accommodated if it's a reasonable accommodation. And there's lots of case law on what is reasonable and what is not. But we know that there's bias. There's implicit bias and there's just good old bad bias that occurs. And people with disabilities across the world are still the highest unemployed of any group. So you name it, they have the highest unemployment. And then you add anything else on top of that, and you're really, doubly disadvantaged, triply disadvantaged. So how you disclose that's really important. And I don't really have an answer because I think it's almost dangerous to say yes, do it or yes, not do it. But I think that if you can help somebody feel comfortable enough to either disclose it before the interview or after the interview, then and ask for accommodations when they do it. Most accommodations are not expensive at all. People think it's going to cost a lot. They're really not. And if you can coach somebody on how to say it, how to ask for what they need, how to describe their impairment or disability in a way that helps people get past it, get through it and around it and back to you as a person, that's really your best strategy.
Yeah. And so really, again, we go back to this idea of it being kind of universal, right? So A, you have to know the law, right? And we know that from other historically marginalized groups, that there are differences in employment law from state to state in the United States or province to province or country to country around the world. And then being knowledgeable about what the challenges are so that you can construct an empowering, autonomous conversation so that the client is considering these things, but making their own choices.
That's right. Absolutely.
I got at least like one leg of the stool at full length, and I'm thinking a lot about the other two. They're a bit rickety right now, Tina. So, well, I just want to say thank you so much. I mean, this has been such the show notes for this one, I think, are going to be quite lengthy. So very informative, I think very specific examples. And then I'm going to capture from Dr. Tina Engtel as many of these sort of sites and tools as I can to make sure that they're shared out widely in the show notes. A, it's just great to see you. I miss you. I miss so many people in my life, but I want to thank you for coming on today and sharing all of this expertise. And any last thoughts or words before I let you go?
No, it's just wonderful to see you. And it's really fun to be able to talk about what I love. So thank you for the opportunity. And I hope people benefit from it.
Great. And keep an eye out. Tina is doing quite a bit of training and things. I know you've been in Singapore recently. You said, I think we're trying to do a trip to APCDA where you'll do some work at some point in the future when we can
Absolutely.
Do live conferences again. And so look for her out there. This is Dr. Brian Hutchison, AKA the Global Career Guy, signing off. We've got 5 episodes of Behind the Science of Career Development. Until next time, take care.